Hello there, Peabody here. Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
All the way back to 2008. Ruination, the early years.
Welcome to Ruination, the early years, the show that takes a stack of information, your articles, your research, your notes, and really just extracts the most essential nuggets of knowledge and insight.
And our mission today is very laser focused. We're summarizing a really pivotal and, I have to say, a highly organized week in the life and stories of Big Fatty Online, or BFO.
That's right.
We're covering episodes 72 through 76, which is Monday, May 12th to Friday, May 16th, 2008. And this week is just a masterclass in duality. We'll be looking at how BFO balances these like extreme domestic details.
Oh, yeah.
Like sharing his mother's bizarre recipes with a high stakes, meticulous logistical planning for these huge social and network events.
This is the week where BSO proves that logistics are content. I mean, we are diving deep into the whole infrastructure of his social world, securing RSVPs, managing listener engagement, network drama.
And a chaotic weekend getaway.
A chaotic weekend getaway to a leather club event, no less. We're basically giving you a shortcut to absolute fluency in BFO's world, where even, you know, a piece of arcane TV trivia becomes a core pillar of his brand.
I'm Gail.
And I'm King. Let's unpack this deep dive into the early years of Ruination. So we have to start by setting the structural stage, right?
Yeah.
Because BFO's entire operation, his whole world, it's built on this really rigid, unwavering consistency. Even when the content itself is just pure, unadulterated chaos.
It is. The week opens with episode 72. That's Monday, May 12th, 2008. And right away, that consistent daily weekday schedule is confirmed. That's the anchor for everything.
The anchor. That's a perfect word for it. It's this reliable point of reference for his whole community.
And that consistency, it's not just, you know, a preference. It's totally foundational to his relationship with you, the listener. Mm. He introduces himself using his chosen moniker, the Fat One, and he immediately lays out what you can expect.
Exactly. The next 20 to 30 minutes, you know what's coming.
You know it. Listener voice letters are coming, readings will be shared, and we're going to get a dose of that twisted up memory lane music. It's this established ritual 5 times a week, and the audience knows exactly what they're tuning in for.
And yet he immediately shatters that expectation of, like, domesticity right from the show's opening. Episode 72 kicks off with this truly jarring clip from the Big Gay Sex Show.
Oh my gosh, yes. We're talking about explicit listener dirty talk in German. It is a shock tactic. It's a deliberate move to instantly say, hey, this show is unrestricted. We're not afraid of explicit content.
But what's so fascinating is that he doesn't just use it for shock value, does he?
No, not at all. He justifies it with a very specific, intimate listener shout out. He frames the chaos as a thoughtful, personal dedication.
Right. He played it for Michael from Stuttgart.
He played this clip, hoping Michael from Stuttgart, Germany, would get a chuckle out of it. And that's the blend, right there. Extreme, boundary-pushing content married immediately to hyper-specific community care. He's acknowledging one person out of thousands, and that makes everyone feel seen.
Totally. He's using other network content as his own chaotic soundscape. You know, it's a quick, jarring transition that just screams, anything goes here. But then just as quickly, he brings the focus right back down to his own hyper-local immediate environment.
He grounds you.
He grounds you completely. He notes that it has suddenly turned a little chilly in Charlestown, which, for new listeners, is North Charleston, South Carolina, where he lives in his home, which he lovingly calls the villa.
And let's not forget, the villa is nestled in Fat Acres. So he gives his residents this grand, almost absurd name, which contrasts so sharply with him just complaining about the temperature dropping.
It's hilarious. He jokes about the thermometer registering in the 50s, saying he might have to pull the camisole back out.
And then he has this great, very human moment where he corrects himself later in the show, admitting he totally misunderstood what a camisole actually is.
That self-correction is so crucial to his brand. He's not this polished, perfect performer. He's the goofy friend who sometimes mispronounces something or gets a piece of lore wrong, and the audience loves that. It's that little bit of relatable vulnerability.
That's the charm.
That is the charm. And this week, domestic stability is kind of back on the menu for him.
It is. He confirmed he finally has the villa back to himself. He'd had a house guest since the previous Tuesday, so he notes he is now being domestic.
And for listeners who track the lore, and believe me, they do meticulously, we know the villa is the craftsman-style one-story structure he would later buy in 2014. So the consistency of his domestic life is this long-running, grounding theme.
Absolutely. And the celebrations keep coming. Episode 75, that's Thursday, May 15th, is marked as this huge, self-invented milestone.
His diamond episode.
His diamond episode, or diamond anniversary, just for hitting number 75.
Right.
But what's so BFO about this is that he links this personal milestone directly to his transactional reality. Payday.
Of course he does.
It's that blend of, you know, personal vanity, network success, and a little nod to the fact that at the end of the day, he's still clocking in just like everybody else.
It's so relatable. He celebrates the arbitrary number 75 with the same energy he celebrates his paycheck arriving.
Yeah.
It just reinforces that he's fundamentally like his audience, dealing with the same financial cycles.
Speaking of his history, this week also features a discussion that integrates his past life. You know, the one before he became the fat one full time.
Right, his eldest daughter, Holly, called in.
And she mentioned seeing him in the movie Forrest Gump.
Now that is a deep cut. We're talking about an uncredited movie extra appearance here.
A deep, deep cut. Holly specifically saw him as one of the reporters running behind Forrest on the bridge. She noted he had long hair and big sideburns at the time.
And here's the best part. She said he made sure he got FaceTime.
Of course he did. That little detail made sure he got FaceTime. That tells you everything you need to know about BFO's personality decades before he ever started the show.
The idea of him, even then, meticulously positioning himself in the background of a huge movie, making sure the sideburns are visible, it's just pure gold. It's an early sign of his innate understanding of performance.
And it contrasts so beautifully with the established lore of his professional life. We know he worked for 40 years at the place he only ever called the coal mine.
His symbolic name for his stable, administrative, probably pretty mundane, white-collar job before he retired in 2018.
So the contrast is perfect. Four decades of stability symbolized by the coal mine versus one brief, glorious, uncredited moment as a long-haired extra in a Tom Hanks movie. It just encapsulates his whole trajectory.
Exactly. It reminds us that behind the microphone is a complicated person with a long history. He's anchoring his identity in these two opposing narratives, the domestic worker focused on his house guest and the self-promoting Hollywood extra.
Which sets the stage perfectly for the chaotic, high-stakes logistics he's about to manage this week.
Okay, so let's pivot from that personal rhythm and history to the intense logistical chaos that is driving the network this week, the massive social planning for these upcoming summer events.
Right, this is the week where BFO basically converts event logistics into mandatory listener participation and content. The urgency is immediate, and it establishes the sense of FOMO right from the top of the show.
Absolutely. He stresses that Monday night, May 12th, the very day episode 72 dropped, was the absolute RSVP deadline for the high tea event. This isn't just a party. This is the key social anchor for Gay Day weekend on Saturday, June 7th. He is using the show to issue an administrative decree.
And the event title itself just encapsulates his brand perfectly. It is formally titled High Tea with Queen Liz and Her Veg.
You can't make this stuff up.
You can't. It immediately sets the tone. A formal setting, high tea, immediately undercut by explicit, irreverent language. And he even mentions they had to move the time up from 3:00 p.m. to 2:00 p.m. to accommodate reservations, which he treats with the gravity of, like, breaking international news.
Logistics are never boring in BFO's world. They are dramatic.
Always. And the attendee list is this perfect convergence of his family and his dedicated fan base. His eldest daughter, Holly, confirmed her RSVP for the tea.
So you have a strong family presence.
Right. But she also adds that she'll be helping to break in the horror room over at Michael and Superb's house. That one sentence, marrying the domestic with the potentially subversive, that's the duality of this community right there.
It shows the complexity of their whole social infrastructure. You can attend a refined tea party with your dad and then immediately go participate in something related to the club's more, shall we say, specific activities.
It's family bonding, BFO style.
We also had Tony from Kansas City RSVP. Now, Tony is a longtime fan from BFO's previous show, The Little Fatty Cast, which shows the continuity of his fan base.
Right. And Tony confirmed he's staying at the Animal Kingdom Lodge, and he suggested a rendezvous at the Peter Pan ride. The specifics here are just wonderful.
It is. You have high-end Disney accommodations meeting classic, almost childlike Disney nostalgia.
And this whole complex social operation is highly managed. It's not just BFO. Michael from QCast set up the entire event schedule on a dedicated blog, podcastgaydays.blogpot.com.
Which requires listeners to navigate multiple web platforms just to attend one event. It increases the sense of insider knowledge you need to have.
The level of detail he expects is just astounding. He mentioned posting guidance notes for afternoon tea with Her Majesty the Queen and the Royal Vag, including explicit instructions on how to address the Queen.
Which is the ultimate example of formal etiquette being imposed on an explicitly irreverent gathering. It's hilarious.
But then he immediately undermines the formality. He admits the text of the guidance notes was too small for him to read.
Of course it was.
So he's imposing this highbrow expectation. But his own, you know, low-tech visual failure transforms the whole thing into an absurdity. He's basically saying, here are the rules, but I can't even follow them myself.
He's giving the audience permission to laugh at the pretense, even as they adhere to the structure. But the planning doesn't stop there. He's also got immediate weekend plans for May.
Yes, he confirms his plan for Friday and Saturday night is going with Miss Kitty to the Hotra Hotel for Armed Forces weekend. Saturday is Armed Forces Day, May 17th.
And this is a totally different kind of logistical planning. This is his personal community outside of the core podcast network.
Right. And for listeners who need the lore context here, the Hora Hotel is the common nickname for the Metropolis Entertainment Complex in Augusta, Georgia. This is where BFO, Miss Kitty, and other core friends like Granny and Durwood are members of a leather club.
It's their official social hub. It's the complete opposite of the domestic comfort of the villa. It's his alter ego's retreat.
And in a classic BFO move, he converts the National Holiday Armed Forces Day into content that mandates explicit audience participation.
I remember this. He jokes that listeners should go out and F a soldier or something this week and then share their sex stories.
Exactly. It's his way of saying your life, no matter how chaotic, is valid content for this show. He takes this widely accepted civic event and immediately filters it through the specific, explicit lens of his community.
And it's all building up to the Orlandoine, which is clearly set to be a total podcaster palooza. He confirms the attendance of key network figures.
Tim from Termly Single, Ryan and Jason from The Way We See It, Taylor the Latte Boy, Rodan, they're all expected.
So the high tea is basically a network convention disguised as a refined social gathering. It's where the personal fans, the family members, and the network colleagues all intersect, reinforcing his central position in this whole ecosystem.
And what's so fascinating is that the urgency of the deadline, the complexity of the guidance notes, they're all functional tools. They turn passive listening into mandatory active involvement.
If you want to be in BFO's world, you have to be ready to navigate his social infrastructure and follow his administrative demands. That's the barrier to entry, and it guarantees loyalty.
It absolutely does. And that loyalty is tested constantly, often through network drama, which brings us to how he manages listener feedback and conflict.
Let's talk about that engagement, because the listener interaction this week is a perfect illustration of how BFO turns feedback and even intense conflict into this ongoing, serialized content, the mailbag and the voicemails. That's the engine of his daily show.
Absolutely. He plays two main voicemails this week, and they serve a really crucial structural function, confirming the logistics we just talked about.
Right. One from Holly, his daughter, and one from Tony, the longtime fan.
Both confirming their high T RSVPs. So it keeps that logistics thread active and shows this immediate payoff for his administrative demands.
But it's not just RSVPs. He also got shout-outs from longtime network loyalists. Frank from Atlanta called in saying he loved episode 69.
Ah, episode 69. For anyone who might not remember, that's the one involving Larry H. Vader, BFO's former co-host. The significance is that their working relationship ended with a lot of public drama.
So for Frank to call in and praise that episode,
it means he's celebrating a foundational moment of chaos and conflict in the network's history. It shows the audience isn't afraid of the internal politics. In fact, they often celebrate it.
That's so true. It validates his decision to turn that conflict into public content. And then we have Kevin from QCA Connection calling in with a kind compliment.
A welcome change of pace.
And a detailed domestic discussion about homemade cream-chipped beef on toast. That little culinary detail just grounds the show right back in the world of comfort food.
And he doesn't just receive content, he actively asks for it. He encourages calls to his voicelet number 206-337-1438. And he specifically asks listeners to comment on whether they've ever mistaken someone for their identical twin. He's trying to generate those specific, weird, relatable anecdotes.
But now, here we go. The epicenter of network drama this week, Kim Beaver-Michael's saga. This whole bizarre incident stems from listener Michael from Stuttgart. the same Michael who was supposed to be chuckling at the German dirty talk clip, sending this strange, threatening e-letter that BFO reads aloud.
And it is truly bizarre.
Yeah.
Michael writes, "Good Lord, Kim, you will rotten forever behind bars. Let's hope that wig of yours will stay in place when you bend over."
I mean, what?
It's not casual conflict. This sounds like a legal threat mixed with a personal insult about a wig. The audience is immediately thrown into the deep end of a rival network feud.
And we should probably pause and establish the stakes here. The Kim Beaver saga is fundamentally about the competition and sometimes the animosity between BFO's world and the network run by Kim Beaver.
Right. And this bizarre message is the aftermath of Kim Beaver's blog post, where she posted a picture of Big Fatty. BFO commented on the photo, saying he found his own picture unexciting. His words were, "I just had to yawn."
Which is such a wonderful meta commentary. He's leveraging a personal grievance, a bad photograph of himself, to drive his audience right into a major network conflict. He's basically saying, if you're going to talk about me, at least use a good photo.
And then he uses this moment to set the record straight on a piece of show lore that defines his identity.
Yeah.
The explicit content creation.
He explicitly denies involvement in that infamous eBay post of the underpants.
Right. He insists that whole thing came from Kim Beaver herself. This is BFO actively trying to rewrite or at least clarify the history of his own most scandalous content.
And he just compounds the absurdity. He offers to forward a phone call to Kim Beaver because he claims he believes she was bidding on the underpants herself.
It's a classic move. Deny direct involvement in the most explicit chaos, but use the rumor that a rival was bidding on his merchandise for entertainment and a little dig.
It's so dynamic. He is simultaneously denying something, promoting the rumor of it, and then encouraging critical thinking by pushing his listeners to go visit Kim Beaver's blog to understand the context of Michael's message.
He's sending his audience on a mission across the network to track the lore, ensuring they become deeply invested in the internal politics.
It's a highly effective, low-stakes entertainment driver. It keeps you hooked because you constantly need more context.
And finally, he wraps up the segment with an essential counterpoint to all the chaos. The listener map update.
Right. He apologized if he missed anyone on the map roll call, noted he added a new listener, and he uses the phrase, "I'm sorry," as this structural cue for the listener.
That "I'm sorry" is the key. It's a moment of meticulous accountability that grounds the show. After wading through German dirty talk, explicit content rumors, and bizarre legal threats, BFO shifts seamlessly into making sure the listener map is accurate.
It's the paradox of his brand in action. Using high-stakes conflict for fuel while simultaneously maintaining this granular, meticulous accountability to his audience.
And that balanced chaos on one hand and detailed domestic attention on the other is precisely what makes him so engaging.
Okay, let's shift to a section that grounds the entire show in pure domestic absurdity, food, and trivia. This is section 4, the domestic and the deep cut.
This section perfectly highlights that high brow low brow paradox of his interests. He uses quirky, almost shocking recipes and obscure quiz show history, not just to entertain, but to really cement his intellectual and familial bond with the audience.
And it starts with his mother's recipes. These aren't just food suggestions. They're like artifacts of his family history. He shares one she sent, the world's easiest chocolate cake.
And the ingredients were shocking in their simplicity. It was one box of chocolate cake mix and a 16-ounce can of Coke or Pepsi. That's it.
He also details the Weight Watchers version, which used diet soda, reinforcing that this is a recipe that's evolved over decades in his family. But BFO found the whole concept way too easy.
Now, that reaction is worth analyzing. Why? Way too easy. If you look at his content creation, he puts so much effort into the daily grind, the constant management. His reaction against the cake being too easy might be his subconscious commentary on effort versus reward.
That's a great point. He prefers the complex, multi-layered effort even in baking. The simple shortcut seems almost suspicious to him.
He applies the same rigorous standards to his kitchen as he does to his content schedule. And he also details his mother's really strange version of macaroni and cheese.
Which he doesn't even call macaroni and cheese. He calls it spaghetti and cheese.
Because it uses spaghetti instead of macaroni. With sharp shredded cheese, butter, and milk, all baked until it's bubbly and gooey. This isn't just a recipe. It's a deep dive into his childhood culinary anchors. It's his food.
And the audience immediately recognizes this and engages. Miss Lauren wrote in about the spaghetti and cheese, but she called it pissetti and cheese, which shows how regional and family lexicons influence food names.
And she offered her own childhood weird food. Chopped meat and rice, which was ground beef, white rice, and tomato sauce.
And BFO, ever the man with strong opinions, immediately disliked it. He demonstrates that while he invites the conversation, he still has strong boundaries about what constitutes acceptable comfort food.
And then we get an alternative dessert from Paul the Kitten Whisperer, another absolutely fantastic specific character name.
We'll love that name.
Paul suggested mixing angel food cake mixed with a 16-ounce can of crushed pineapple, adding cinnamon or pumpkin spice if it was too sweet. The audience isn't just passively consuming, they're providing content, critique, variations. BFO's kitchen becomes a collaborative space.
And this domestic food-focused discussion is balanced by his ongoing intellectual engagement with other network stars, specifically the miniseries Growing Old and Gay,
which he's doing with Annie Vera Charles, a foundational figure in the network lore. She's known as the old gal, the sea hag, and she lives in Walnut Hills, California. BFO thanks listeners for the positive reaction to their discussions, which focus on their lives decade by decade.
It's a moment of serious biographical reflection, and it's significant that both hosts are 52 years old at this time. Their shared lived experience gives the miniseries real weight.
And BFO reveals a classic moment of ruination in the making of this serious miniseries. He admits he failed to hit the record button for the segment covering their 20s.
Of course he did.
But he notes they just refer back to it in the next recordings. That error, the dumbass big fatty moment, is a crucial part of his brand's honesty. He doesn't edit out his mistakes. He incorporates them into the narrative.
And the fan comments reveal the audience's appreciation for that vulnerability. They praise the segment for providing deep insight and being touching. It shows the audience needs that genuine biographical detail, not just the chaos.
Now let's transition to the structure that directly tests the listener's cultural knowledge. Memory Lane Music. He changes it up this week to a game called Who's the Host? He plays three clips from different quiz shows hosted by the same person.
This is a classic example of BFO leveraging his hyper-specific interests to create mandatory audience engagement. If you want to play along, you need to know deep cut TV history.
Tuesday's answer revealed the subject to be the quiz show powerhouse, Bill Cullen. And BFO wasn't just dropping a name. He was providing astounding trivia. He reveals Cullen hosted 23 different game shows.
23? That's the most in television history. That is an incredible piece of trivia.
It really is. BFO lists some of his major gigs. The original host of The Price is Right from 1956 to 1965.
And the nighttime version of Pyramid, Chain Reaction, Blockbusters, The Joker's Wild. He's not just celebrating Cullen, he's celebrating a specific era of TV history that has shared nostalgia for his demographic.
And BFO adds that crucial, often overlooked biographical detail. Cullen had polio and often had trouble walking on stage, which is why the cameras often kept him seated behind a desk. BFO called him the quintessential original quiz show host.
And including the polio detail elevates the segment beyond mere trivia. It shows BFO values the full complex story of these cultural figures, including their personal struggles. This is his version of a history lesson. Detailed, nuanced, and slightly irreverent.
Exactly. We've covered the network logistics, the rival drama, the domestic recipes, and the intellectual deep cuts. Let's finish with BFO's greatest talent. Elevating small, specific personal grievances and truly absurd facts into major content pillars.
This is Section 5, The Chaos of Mundane Observations.
And it serves as his weekly opportunity to critique his local environment. It starts with a truly bizarre legislative deep dive. BFO reads a list of absurd South Carolina laws he found, using them as a perfect springboard to portray himself as a victim of legislative absurdity.
The first contrast is just immediately baffling, and he hammers it home. Police officers need 396 hours of training.
Yeah.
But cosmetologists need 1,500 hours to learn how to wash hair, as BFO emphasizes. This juxtaposition immediately questions the state's priorities, and he uses it to generate this shared, exasperated laughter with his audience.
He's basically saying, look at the bureaucracy I have to live under. Then the details get even stranger and funnier. He notes that barber schools must have at least 10 instructional chairs.
And every single one of those chairs must be upholstered and finished exactly the same way. The level of legislative micromanagement over aesthetics is just, it's absurd.
It feels medieval. And it continues. Fortune tellers need a special permit to open a shop. This is BFO looking around his community and just pointing out the bizarre, specific regulatory hurdles that exist in his corner of the world.
It makes his content hyperlocal and specific, and then the most mundane, almost Victorian restriction.
Musical instruments are not allowed to be sold on Sunday.
Which seems completely arbitrary in 2008, and BFO uses it to draw a conclusion that solidifies his whole persona. Welcome to South Carolina! He uses these random, ridiculous facts to create a shared, humorous identity with his audience, uniting them against the perceived absurdity of government.
It's a recurring theme. He positions himself as a common-sense, slightly grumpy voice reacting to an overly complicated world. This relatable political persona is built entirely on micro-grievances like these.
He wraps up the working week by reminding listeners he's taking Friday off for the horror hotel trip. And he urges them to call the bag phone, his vintage nickname for the voice lit number over the weekend, noting he hasn't had many calls lately.
This is a moment of pressure. He's managed logistics all week, celebrated milestones, driven drama. But the content machine always needs to be fed. His plea for calls is the constant pressure he operates under, the recognition that his show depends entirely on the unpredictable flow of audience interaction.
And the show ends on this utterly strange physical note. He mentions playing an audio clip that gave him a sudden, uncontrollable urge to run to the toilet.
Or the turlet, as he calls it.
The turlet. So he's ending the show by highlighting the power of suggestion in his own soundscape, applied to a visceral bodily function. The show starts with German dirty talk, the explicit, and ends with a confession of needing to run to the restroom, the deeply mundane and physical.
And that raises an important question, doesn't it? He's constantly seeking out and amplifying these small, absurd failures. The forgotten record button, the need to rush to the bathroom, the mistake about the camisole. Is he doing this because they are the most relatable, honest content anchors?
I think the answer is absolutely yes. The failures are the proof that the chaos is real.
Okay, so let's unpack this for the final time. This week, we saw BFO perfectly leverage his most intimate plans, from the exact time of the high tea with Queen Liz and her vag, to his mother's strange spaghetti recipe, to cement his connection with the audience. His world is an ongoing, highly structured performance where even a simple RSVP deadline becomes a test of community loyalty.
What's truly fascinating here is how he almost weaponizes logistics and esoteric trivia, things like reservation deadlines, guidance notes for royalty, the entire history of Bill Cullen. He turns them into mandatory participation for his audience.
Exactly. If you want to be fully immersed in BFO's universe, you have to RSVP, you have to know Bill Cullen, and you absolutely have to engage with the network's internal drama. So what does this all mean for you, the listener? Well, BFO shows us that even the most niche, specific interest, whether it's obscure game show hosts or a fight with a rival podcaster or a half-baked cake recipe, can be the foundation of a thriving, intimate, and dedicated community.
The key is just committing fully and consistently to both the chaos and the required administrative structure.
That raises an important question for you to mull over. What obscure, specific piece of cultural knowledge or deeply held personal belief do you possess that, if you shared it with consistent enthusiasm and transparency, could become the next foundation of a community?
Think about that. We hope you enjoyed today's look at Ruination, the early years.
We'll see you then. I'm Gail.
And I'm King.
Join us again next weekend for the newest episode of Ruination, the early years.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's trip down memory lane on Ruination, the early years. Join us again next weekend. We'll see you then.